Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And 2010 was the year of The Social Network, both the movie and the real thing. It was the year, I think right at the end of the year, where Facebook actually passed Google for the most used website. Facebook is hoping to kind of stage a Facebookization of the World Wide Web, where people do much more through social networking than they do through search. We saw the new valuation of Facebook today at $50 billion after a big investment by Goldman Sachs. But there's more in the world and on the World Wide Web than status updates and retweeting. Since leaving the New York Times just over a year ago, reporter Jennifer Ait Lee has been traveling the world, literally, looking for what's new in media platforms and social networks, Facebook, Twitter, and many, many others. She's been looking for innovation everywhere from Malaysia to Monaco, from map making to translation. She was in Barcelona for Spain's World Cup victory, in Vancouver for the Winter Olympics, at South by Southwest, and at the Sundance Film Festival in 2010. And she's here in New York today and joins us now on WNYC. Welcome back, Jennifer Ait Lee.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Exciting to have you here in your exciting new role. And you're also the author, if people don't remember, of the Fortune Cookie Chronicles, and you traveled extensively looking into the history of Chinese food for that book. But you've been focused on a different purpose these days. You're now a leader in the Knight News Challenge, which supports news innovation. So what's been the goal of your work in the last year?
So over the last year, what I've been really interested in is thinking about the new kind of infrastructure that has to fill in the vacuum that exists as legacy media sort of recedes. So what are the new kinds of structures and new kinds of organizations and new kinds of outlets that are sort of emerging from the fray? So like a good example.
And legacy media, we should say. Legacy media really means old media like radio, television, and print.
Yeah, and newspapers, yeah. That's sort of the umbrella term that's sort of developed in the last couple of years to refer to sort of the more establishment media. So one of the things that we're really kind of interested in is, for example, something like Wikipedia, right? Wikipedia sort of predates a lot of sort of the crisis mode of in journalism, but the fact that it even exists and it came to being is sort of a new kind of model for news information in informed societies. And so there's another project that's sort of similar to it called OpenStreetMap, which is often referred to as the Wikipedia of mapping. And the idea there is, while in the United States most of us are used to Google Maps having really high quality information about roads and towns and like locations of things, in much of the world there isn't enough of a commercial interest for there to be this kind of information. So people go out in Ethiopia or in like New Zealand or even in Germany and England, and they create their own maps, and they upload their information in a crowdsourced way into a central database. And that project's called OpenStreetMap. And so I was actually in Girona, Spain, in July for the State of the Map conference. This is their sort of annual big conference. And it was amazing to see all the projects from around the world that sort of been built on OpenStreetMap. And one of the best examples is actually after the Haiti earthquake, mm-hmm. When that happened, there actually wasn't high-quality maps of, downtown Port-au-Prince or even the surrounding area. So what happened was satellite imagery is often released as a condition of a world, sort of a large natural disaster. And people took those satellite images, and around the world, there is this amazing video of people tracing the roads, and the streets and the alleyways, and then trying to create sort of a robust map that then the first responders could use in order to sort of rescue people and respond to injuries or bring water. And that was sort of a very impressive project.
And, have a video on our website in case people are interested from OpenStreetMap showing how this map of Haiti was created by the public using these satellite images and aerial photography released after the earthquake. But Jennifer, do you know if the first responders then actually used it, or did it just kind of feel good for people to create and for us in the media to look at?
So in that case, in Haiti, what happened was there were actually first responders who wrote in to a project called Ushahidi, which is sort of a crowdsourced sort of plotting mapping project that was built on top of the map that was created. And they said, I mean, these are, you know, military officials from the U.S. Coast Guard who basically said this. They saved hundreds of lives. Like, they didn't actually have enough time to document all the cases because they had to move on to the next person to save. But by far, it was like the State Department sort of and the U.S., the sort of the U.S. first responders' first point of reference. And it was the highest quality of, point of reference. So from what we understand, it actually had a very significant impact within Haiti. That being said, other sort of, you know, sort of crowdsourced map projects haven't necessarily had the same kind of, like, you know, life or death kind of situation, but mm-hmm. it's been really interesting to see how different entities could use, you know, mapping, like, you know, during snowstorms, like, people can say, I can help, I need help shoveling, you know, I have an extra shovel. So if there can be a critical mass built around a certain kind of map, you can actually have a very effective way that communities can sort of engage with themselves.
And in fact, let's take a call from Olin Prospect Heights, who says he's participated in two crowd mapping projects. Raul, thanks for calling. How are you?
Great. Happy New Year.
Same to you.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was part of a group called Alliance Guinée, which helped map election problems in Guinea, West Africa. And then more recently, I did something for snow removal in Brooklyn. And I was pretty amazed that just through Facebook and Twitter and some blog posts, I got many hundreds of responses and some pretty interesting information.
I guess more recently, like last week, snow removal in Brooklyn. And do you think that you were able to learn anything through that mapping? And we were doing mapping, too, during the snow and having people report in and, you know, hoping that people could use that in the first responders world in New York to get through, because, of course, there were so many emergencies that it was hard to respond to. Were you able to document with either of the maps that you participated in actual uses that people were able to put them to?
Well, in Guinea, we had some really amazing successes that people from certain towns reported to us via their cell phones that they didn't have enough election materials, and we were able to contact the appropriate authorities in Guinea, and they got the materials. So people got to vote because of our project. You know, we were up at Columbia University putting all this information in, and it had a real effect in Guinea. And that's, I'm very proud that people got to vote because of what we did. There was a lot of information I got on the from the snowstorm, and that I'm still culling through, and I'm going to be working with my city council person and hopefully some other people to analyze what happened. But that's still, it's raw data. So you have to look at it pretty carefully, because people send in all sorts of stuff and you have to verify it.
And sometimes it's wrong. That's right.
Yeah.
Raul, thank you very much for calling in. We're talking with Jennifer Ait Lee, who's documenting uses of social media around the world for the Night News Challenge. And you went to China this year as well, which is a country that people usually first think of with respect to censorship and the internet and social media. But you were looking at other things there. What about China?
So I was there for a conference, but one of the things that it was sort of a high school conference that brings together a whole bunch of students. But one of the interesting things in China is they have there's a really interesting collaborative translation project called Yiyan, Y-E-E-Y-A-N. And what happens there is they're in order to open up China to the rest of the sort of the world media, what people do is they take, you know, all these articles that are available, the ones that are not censored, and then they translate them into English. And with varying kind of levels of kind of competency, mm-hmm. but generally they've discovered that the better philosophy is to have a big tent, that to invite more people to translate, even when the quality is not that great. And it's been this sort of very, you know, it had become a very, very vibrant project. And it's interesting because there was, they've learned not to do stuff that's too political. So it tends to be more lifestyle, tends to be more business, because at a certain point, you know, some of the political-ish stuff wasn't so kindly received, I guess, by the powers that be. So that's an interesting project that, in terms of how the collaborative process is structured, could be ported to other kinds of languages and other kinds of countries, right? So it'd be really interesting to see if, like, Spanish English could, you know, really take off, or, you know, Russian English, or, you know, any number of countries. But there was just something that sort of worked really well in China that had the right alchemy to motivate people to sort of translate and, you know, kind of get self-satisfaction from that.
So it's like a people's translation service through social networking. And I gather the EN site allows all translations, even bad ones, but they use game theory to reward good translations with badges, yes?
Right, exactly. So it's a little bit, there actually is not only there, but over, you know, sort of an entire news industry, the idea of, like, how can the mechanics of game, how can game mechanics be used in an effective way across many, many different, you know, aspects, not just sort of incenting people to sort of translate, but incenting people to report, or incenting people to give good comments, or incenting people to share effectively. So there is, it's a very, very actually vibrant area. And one of the things that we're planning, hopefully, to do in the spring is to do a game mechanics and news hackathon, where there's a big hackathon. So there's a big gaming company out of Seattle that has studied this, and they want to kind of bring their technology and some of their programming and aspects to news. And so we think that's really fascinating. It's a very kind of still kind of new field, but definitely one that we're paying attention to.
Now, in the United States these days, many people have said that the future of successful news operations lie in hyper-local media. Have you seen that in other countries?
I would say definitely in one of the projects that the Night News Challenge funded last year was something called Goat Map Riga, which is out of Riga in Eastern Europe. And basically the idea there is, what we take for granted in the United States in terms of having access to mapping and, you know, people being civically engaged, they were trying to basically use mapping as a way to sort of in an area that has historically not been kind of civically engaged. And we definitely have seen kind of other proposals come out of the woodwork.
I gather that you reported on Malaysia, where there's a kind of hyper-local news operation out of coffee shops.
Right. Well, so that is a proposal that came in this year from the Night News Challenge. It hasn't necessarily launched there. But in that kind of, in that situation, what the project is it tries to build buildings on top of what their coffee shops, what they call kopitoms, and to use that as a backbone of, you know, almost since they are sort of like a neighborhood hub, a neighborhood gossip site, that you use the sort of entire world, you know, nationwide network, or at least regional networks of these places, to be places where people can both give information and report, you know, and report information. And, you know, we'll see how that goes in terms of the Night News Challenge and how it progresses. But one of the interesting things about that proposal is that it was actually kind of proposed from a much more sort of mainstream established, or mainstream is not the right word. It is coming from a media outlet that's already fairly established. So the vision, that kind of vision married with the experience, kind of makes it, gives it an interesting potential.
Tell us what you're doing with the South by Southwest conference this year, which I gather for the first time will have a section devoted to news.
Yeah, so there are different aspects that are going into the South by Southwest conference. One of the most exciting things that we're kind of watching and being involved with is there's a startup competition called Accelerator, and one of the categories this year is sort of news and publishing related technologies. So that's one aspect. Another aspect that's going to happen out of the South by Southwest conference is basically there are a number of tracks that have been there is a day-long track basically that because the content of the news proposals has become so strong that this is the first year they're sort of introducing it. So I thought that sort of said a lot about the convergence of technology and sort of the news industry. And, you know, another thing is there's going to be a series of meetups, and there's going to be, I think, a lot of sort of techie, newsy companies and services are also going to exhibit in the trade show, which will be significant.
Does it reflect a changing place of news in our culture? Because, you know, usually when we think of South by Southwest, we think of music and film and more cultural interaction when people go down to Austin. We don't think of news. We don't think of journalism.
Right. So South by Southwest Interactive, which is one of the three major sort of pillars of the South by Southwest Conference, has become gigantic. I think last year or something, I think it was like either 11,000 or 14,000 people. So as that has become dominant, it has become a very key place for anyone that's interested in you know, digital technologies, including news information, to sort of go and be involved and see what's going on. And what it actually, I think, indicates is that historically, those people who are interested in news had a, you know, who are very civically minded. If your main talent was writing or, you know, policy, then there were ways that you can sort of engage civically, right? Either as a journalist or as a politician or as, you know, a staff member of a politician. But what has happened in the, you know, last, I would say 10 years, 15 years, is that people whose main like talent is programming or technology, now they have a way to become civically engaged, right? They can create, you know, cool mashups that, you know, take, you know, the data on, you know, roach sightings from the, you know, from the public health department, they can scrape down and put that on a map, right? And so there is a new outlet for them that may not have previously existed in such an effective way. So what we're seeing is sort of an opening up of the ways that people can help inform their communities. And it's great. You know, we're trying to basically get the relationships built between those who have the technical skills and those who kind of have a sense of what communities care about, and to try to, like, you know, bring that chemistry together so that you can have cool new projects.
Of course, you can't make a map unless you have the information.
Right. Very much so.
We're almost out of time with Jennifer Ait-Lee, author of The Fortune Cookie Chronicles, former New York Times reporter, now traveling the world physically and virtually, documenting social media uses around the world for the Knight News Challenge. And before you go, you recently also made some predictions for 2011 for the Nieman Journalism Lab. And one interesting thing is that you wrote that the coming year might see the rise of more anonymous Dropbox formats, that is, like WikiLeaks. What do you see other than WikiLeaks itself?
Well, there's a new project there called OpenLeaks, which is created by people who have signed, a number of people who resigned from the main WikiLeaks project and have a different vision, a much more distributed vision, and that's sort of gotten some media. And there have been kind of interesting sightings. I haven't seen any of these projects, but I've heard of them, like IndoLeaks, you know, to do with Indonesia, and BrusselsLeaks, to do with the EU, and what else is there? And there's one that's I even heard called like Chicky Leaks, which I think might have to do with Chicago or poultry, but I think it's actually Chicago. So
leaks.
You can see sort of, you know, this sort of this proliferation. And it's interesting because I actually don't know what the quality is of the technology is.
Mm-hmm.
But it is not a trivial kind of doing that anonymous Dropbox is not trivial. So it'll be interesting to see how robust those systems are going forward.
And you don't know the quality of the material either when something is dropped in an anonymous Dropbox. People have to vet it.
Yeah, the vetting. That's why, you know, OpenLeaks, for example, has put a very strong emphasis, from what I understand, on pushing things towards journalists, like people who have historic experience vetting.
And you also predicted the rise of what you call Little Brother in 2011. What's Little Brother?
So it's something that we've been seeing over time, but this idea of that we've always been afraid of Big Brother, which, you know, in terms of technology development, that, oh, it's going to be the government who's going to sort of watch us and surveil us. But in reality, you're more likely to be sort of, you know, watched or captured on tape or recorded or have a photo taken of by someone who's right around you, like a neighbor or, you know, someone that's on the street or a friend or whatever, because they are the ones, now that we all have cell phones that take video and photos, you know, they can capture these more intimate moments, right? Or another good example is, you know, the files can be captured, you know, more likely to be sort of copied by someone who has a USB, like thumb drive, than you know, someone who sort of has developed, you know, this like large, massive, you know, spying system on, you know, watching stuff pass through. So the reality, so the point that I make is that, you know, what things like YouTube videos have shown us is that a lot of the news can kind of come from the grassroots, that we can actually create accountability journalism, you know, by vigilance on sort of the grass, you know, on sort of the local level. The trick is, you know, once those things are just kind of captured, how do you get attention to sort of the most outrageous stuff, sort of, into the mainstream? Like, how do you catapult that? And so that those are sort of mechanisms that are sort of interesting.
How does little brother use all those images of all kinds of regular people responsibly? And then also when they really have something, how do they turn it into news distributed in a way that it would make a difference? So some of the questions going forward for 2011 and some of the observations from Jennifer 8 Lee, looking at news, new media, and social media around the world for the Night News Challenge. Fascinating stuff. Jennifer, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, with the first baby boomers turning 65 on New Year's Day, we will have a call-in. First, for anybody who does turn 65 yourself this year. So this is for you right now for the next few minutes. If you are turning 65 in 2011, call us and tell us how you think history should remember the virtues and vices of the baby boom generation at 212-433-WNYC. If you're turning 65 this year, the phones are open for you now at 212-433-9692 on the meaning of your generation. And then we'll take calls from other people, non-boomers, who have questions for baby boomers, and we'll match you up. 212-433-WNYC if you're turning 65 this year. 212-433-9692.